3, 2, 1.
Woo! Happy Friday. I'm over here like jamming out to the music. No one can even see me. I'm having a dance party. Happy Friday, Madtropolis. We are here. We finished this week. Oh my gosh. I'm so excited to see you guys. You see my new logo. For those of you who missed us last Friday, we did a new logo reveal. There's a new website. Yes, V, I'm making intros. V is the one who told me to make the intros. It's not really my big idea, but we're getting professional. Thank you to Lean Marketing. They are doing all the graphics, intros, website. Go check out the website. Amanda Miller will drop the website link in the comments. And you can also watch us live on the website as well. So Lean Marketing is getting me all professional. V will be happy. Ron will be happy. Andrew Teal will be happy. Chandler will be happy. Everybody's going to be freaking happy today, except for me. All right, so we've got an exciting show today. For those of you who want to nerd it out on mergers and acquisitions and where our industry is going, this is the episode for you. We are sponsored today by SwanLeap, my favorite TMS. I like this TMS because I've told you guys before in the past, I stand behind them because they're unique. They're integrated with your customers already. They're flexible. They have great reporting. And they're not that old clunky TMS that you're used to using. They give you a competitive advantage. You can streamline processes, automate tasks, and you can drive better margins through their software. The CEO of SwanLeap, my favorite person, Brad, he has given us 6 months free. So the link is in this description here. You can click on it. You can get it for free for 6 months and check it out and let me know what you think. We are going to start our show first, but I want to say something. I already see a snarky comment in the crowd because Bill, one of my favorite guests, is wearing a Pearl Jam.
Yes. Shirt.
And Ron Kane has told me, look at him. You see his comment? He says, Pearl Jam? Question mark. And the reason why he's saying that is because, unlike me and you, Bill, Ron does not like Pearl Jam.
Ron clearly has no taste.
I think he doesn't have any taste either. Ron, drop in the comments who your favorite group is, and maybe we could better understand your music taste, because not liking Eddie Vedder's voice is, it's not possible. We've got Drew with us. We've got Matt Fink with us. We've got Matt Linder with us. V, of course, Todd Burke. We got everybody. I love it. Ron says Eddie Vedder sounds like a circumcision in process.
Ouch.
Oh, ow. That is so not true, Ron. I love Eddie Vedder. What is Pearl Jam? What is going on with you, V? All right, so we got... All right, it's a wild start. It's a wild start. Bill, why don't you go first introducing yourself to Madtropolis, because you already clearly fit right in with your Pearl Jam, and you're going to tell us what's the beanie says, because I'm intrigued to hear the story on this.
Yeah, thanks. I was told that I would look a whole lot cooler if I wore a beanie, and it would also hide the fact that I'm losing all of my hair, so that's dual purpose. So yeah, I'm Bill Gudgeon. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Trans Group Global Logistics. We're a $1.5 billion international freight forwarder. We provide domestic 3PL services, customs brokerage. We have 115 plus offices in 25 countries, about 2,000 employees. Here in North America, we operate under the brand name Trans Group Global Logistics. Outside of North America and all other countries, we operate under the brand name SCAN Global Logistics. So sometimes people get confused. It's not that confusing, but
let me just check. You mean SCAN, S-C-A-N, as in November? Or M as in Mary.
As in November, as in Scandinavia.
Okay, good. I just know some smart asses in the crowd who are going to be like, yeah
there's always a few. They're probably setting me up. So our global headquarters is in Copenhagen. And then our North American headquarters is here in lovely Seattle.
Yes, I love it. Even
though Ron won't agree, the home to great music. So yeah, happy to be here. And my beanie says P&W Peak Baggers. I'm when I'm not working and not playing music over
that
there.
That is so cool.
I like to climb mountains, so have a group of friends of mine, and I started up a group called P&W Peak Baggers, and we have several thousand people in the Pacific Northwest in that group. We coordinate climbs and hikes and talk about gear. So if you're into that, check it out.
John's yeah, you should check it out.
John has already signed up and is now a P&W Peak Bagger, so he's into it. So
Number 9001, yeah.
Right, and Cassandra informed us that she gets tired walking up and down the stairs, so.
Yeah, that's my mountain climbing. And, well, actually, the other day I had to reach high on top of the fridge for a bottle of wine, and I felt like that was definitely climbing.
Treacherous. Yeah. Should have been roped.
Yeah. John, will you introduce yourself to Madtropolis? We are so excited to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Cassandra. And Bill went all the way cementing any lack of cool that I may have had already. You called us industry veterans from the beginning, which is already cementing how old I am. And Bill's got a few years on me, but he's wearing a beanie and a Pearl Jam, and I think I saw an electric guitar in the corner of your room. So any chance of me being cool has long left the building, and I'm wearing a button down. So there you go. But hey, it's good to be on. This is my first time here. You know, I share one thing in common with everyone in Madtropolis, and that's like just a deep kind of dorky and nerdy love for all mm-hmm. things transportation and logistics. I came here a different route than many folks that have kind of grown up in, lived and breathed from, you know, high school or college on transportation. I started in corporate finance and investment banking, moved back to Phoenix in 2008 and joined a private equity group where I kind of learned to put my money where my mouth was, make investments, pony up, really understand the businesses that you're getting behind. Versus being an advisor, you know, you do need to know the business, you need to understand it intimately, but there's a different level of commitment and living with an idea when you're investing in it. And I think Bill will get into this later too. There's a whole different level when you're integrating something in and it's going to become a living, breathing part of your organization. So after that in 2015, I kind of looked around. It doesn't take many people to manage money. So at my time, I was in my early 30s at a successful private equity firm here in Phoenix. And I had three guys that I respected a lot and treated as mentors, but they were in their 50s, their 60s, and their 70s. And I wanted to be on the other side of the table, getting my hands dirty, digging in on operations. So I had the chance to join Knight Transportation in early 2015 and spend half of my time executing mergers and acquisitions, integrating that as a system within the business, and the rest of my time focusing on pricing and network where I led those groups. And what I'd say on the system side is, you know, Knight had closed bar none in October of 2014. And they had been active in the M&A markets, but hadn't done a deal for 8 years before that. And I think some of the topics Bill and I will hit on is situating yourself with a mindset and with a conviction around M&A that for the next 6 years after Knight closed, and we closed together a deal per year after that. And it became a real systemic and living and breathing part of our organization and an arm for growth. And I love your sensational headlines, Cassandra. You don't mince words. You get out there, and I saw some of the comments early on around, well, hey, we're growing.
Yeah, we're growing. Organic growth is possible.
I just grew right now. I just grew 2 minutes ago. And yeah, it's all good. I love the backdrop because in truckload, which is where I cut my teeth, right, the last 6 years, it is immensely difficult to grow yeah, right now. So looking forward to a good conversation. Already enjoyed getting to know Bill and the Madtropolis crew somewhat here already.
And it was fun to talk to you both because Bill comes with the experience, a significant amount of experience, merging two companies together, being that person who is executing the two companies coming together. And then we have John, who's been part of execution, but a lot of the part of the buying and the selling and targeting. And so I think it's a really great blend of the two people. If anybody has questions throughout the episode, look for my favorite freight broker based out of Alabama. She knows flatbed very well if you're looking for a flatbed broker. Her name is Amanda Miller, and she just do the at symbol and with Amanda, and she'll see you and just send her your question. And I have my cell phone on me, and Amanda will just text me what your questions are, because sometimes our feed gets wild and then I miss questions. And then Ron gets mad at me again. So let's start with, let me pull up my notes, because this is going to be an intense episode. What was the first thing I wanted to talk about? Well, wait, John, could you tell me what you want to talk about first? Where's the best part place to start?
I love what you kicked off from the beginning. Is like, is M&A the only way to grow? And I think we'll hit on that, but just for the price of admission for M&A, you may ask yourself, like, how does a company start to investigate or understand how they can approach M&A? And there's probably, Bill will attest to this, there's probably 100 different ways to think about the M&A opportunity set and how you approach inorganic growth as a strategy for your company. The way that's always worked well for me is to, and this is helps from a planning perspective, is to think of it as a system and break it into a few different parts. There are bolt-on acquisitions, which you could think of, Cassandra, as investments. Mm-hmm. And largely speaking, it's the way that asset management firms buy stocks, or Warren Buffett buys a company. They buy it because they love the management team. They love what they're doing. They want to invest in them and let them continue on their way. That's number one. And there's certain things there that you need to maybe understand. The second is tuck-ins. And I think one of the commentators you had talked about doing some tuck-ins before. This is heavy on integration and execution, right? It's one thing to be able to analyze whether or not it's a good deal and whether the numbers make sense. This one, you've got to shift really quickly into integration mode. And then the last one, I would say, mm-hmm. is visionary or transformational. If all you've known is truckload forever,
yep.
and you're going to get into LTL or flatbed or parcel, it's just a different beast. You kind of have to be able to do both. You got to be able to underwrite the numbers and do that. And these all, you know, when I look back and take a step back in trucking specifically, it has been unbelievably hard to grow the last 10 years, heck, maybe even 15 years. There was a research report I saw from Stifel that had the 12 large public truckload carriers.
Yep.
And one of the 12 has grown year over year. Now, if you went back 5 years, I don't know what it's going to say, but over the last year, only one of the 12, and it was almost entirely on their dedicated division. So growing truckloads difficult. So with that said, you can do low risk, low reward, which is organic, or across these, you have more mid risk, mid reward, all the way to visionary and transformational, which is where I hope Bill and I get into this. But there's been some duds where people reach for the stars and it's high risk, high reward, and it flops. Think through the opportunity sets that are out there.
Bill, what has been your experience when you've worked for companies and they've dropped a merger on your lap that you have to execute, or an acquisition, and you thought to yourself, we could have grown this organically, if that makes sense? Because I would have. Sometimes a merger has been dropped on my lap, or acquisition, not merger. And I've been like, we could have done this organically. We didn't really need to buy these guys.
Yeah, I think, you know, that it's interesting. You know, John didn't specifically say this, but I know that when we talked about this earlier, one of the things to keep in mind is there's not one single path, right? So it's not a I have to grow organically or make an acquisition. You can do both. I mean, companies have proven that, right? Where they've opened up their own offices or opened up in countries or they've partnered with people and, you know, eventually have even acquired those partners and or agents that they work with. So it's not an all or nothing strategy. And I think, and we're going to get into this, but where acquisitions fail most of the time, a lot of people say it's because companies overpaid and, you know, then they regret it later. And that's the reason, you know, ultimately they fail. And, you know, the whole adage of price is what you pay and value is what you get is absolutely true in this space. But I think really what it boils down to is the lack of having a strategy on, you know, one of those three options that John talked about. You know, what is your real strategy? I mean, if you're just opportunistic and you just sort of take whatever comes by and you take a look at it and say, oh, that's a great deal because of price,
right,
then you're going to fail. What you really have to understand is how does that potential acquisition fit into your overall strategy? And if you are going the route of the tuck-in integration, then you have to also understand the cost to you and not just the benefit. I mean, there is a cost when you integrate companies versus just rolling them in. If you have an integration strategy, you have to get it right and you have to have a playbook and you have to have, you know, a very defined systemic process to make that work. You can't just, you know, kind of hope that, you know,
makes sense.
You'll move through that strategy. So, I mean, it all fundamentally starts there. I mean, I don't know what the numbers are. I mean, people say it ranges between 70 and 90% of acquisitions fail on some kind of level. I don't know how true that is, but I mean, it does start with the strategy, right?
Yeah.
Hey, Bill, how many of those do you feel like are before you close on them, how many deals fall apart between a buyer and a seller? And what would those reasons be? Because I think there's a big difference between what scuttles a deal prior to close and what wrecks it afterwards.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I think actually that in some cases, that's a good thing that a high degree of those fail, because you would hope that you go through that diligence process and find out that it's not the right fit. You know, one or both parties come to agreement that, hey, this is not a good cultural fit for us, or we don't agree with the post-integration strategy. Because otherwise, when you do that, that means you're being transparent, right? You're having the tough conversations. You're making sure that everybody's clear on what needs to happen afterwards. I mean, this is like one of the things that can drive the operations people crazy, is there's all this front end work and all these late night dinners and cocktails and conversations about, you know, the two companies coming together and, you know, all this work on the acquisition side. And then, as Cassandra said earlier, it's suddenly now just dumped in the hands of people that are told to go execute. And they're like, they're not even really clear on what the execution plan is. So, you know, involving the right people as early in the process is sort of critical. And like I said, I'm okay if you go through that process and people say, this is not the right fit. You should do that more times than not, right?
So yeah. I see some of the questions rolling in, but I actually wanted to take one more step back, which is, if I am, let's say I'm a mid-size logistics company and truckload, and I'm like, I want to grow. I'm hearing the buzz about freight matching over here. I'm hearing that these folks over here are just killing it with LTL. I just want to grow. John, where do I start with that? How can you help work us into a strategy from a high level, or questions that you would ask to help somebody decide, well, hey, do you really want to buy this over here, or do you just want to try to hire a bunch of salespeople and grow organically that direction? let's try to like give the leaders a little guidance on which direction. And like Bill said, it doesn't have to be one or the other, but where is the best fit for one or the other to make, when you make a decision?
No, I think that's good. I think when you do a buy versus build analysis, there's the hard cost that you get to write down, right? How much would it cost for this many salespeople, or time that it would take to execute this plan? But from what I've seen, and this is in the public markets, looking at, you know, many CEOs, CFOs talking about their roadmap, is sometimes the lack of being brutally honest with yourself on if you'll really get to something and how long it will take and what the likelihood is. So it's not the hard costs, it's the opportunity cost of not developing something. So if LTL has been on your roadmap every year at your strategy session for 5 years, and it's like it's just every single time it's number four on your list of strategic initiatives, right? Everyone's got that one. It's top 10, but it hasn't moved from number four for 5 years. You've got to keep that in mind in your buy versus build, because it's easy to just put it on paper and say, look, it's cheaper to do this.
Yep.
And then it's about the clarity of vision and your conviction on being able to get it done either through the acquisition or through developing it yourself. So if this is going to be the year, finally, year six is going to be the year, you've got the horses, you know how you're going to do it, who's going to come in. But on the other side, M&A is not the place to go and FIO, right? Go figure it out. You've got to have an equal amount of vision. I'm really comfortable with this management team that I'm going to hire or buy, right? You're going to acqui-hire them. That I've done my character and background checks. I've talked to people they know in the industry. I've talked to some of their customers. You have to be crystal clear. And this, I think, Bill, goes to whether it's a full price deal or a good deal. Because I think some of these in the middle where their tuck-ins exist, you can find carve-outs. You can find some distressed sales, right? There's a deal done recently with TFI where they purchased the old remnants of Overnight Express, UPS Freight, right? And anytime you're buying $3 billion in revenue for about 25% of that, you're getting a good deal. Most companies that are flourishing and have reasonable margins don't trade at that. So you need to be really clear, even in those low price deals, what you're getting, who's going to own it, and how they're going to execute. The other question to piggyback on that someone wrote was, how is this different for a small deal, right? Like, there's $800 million deals, and then there could be $8 million.
Yeah, that was Matt Fink. I just saw Amanda Miller send that to me. Matt Fink is one of my favorite Metropolis people over from Green Bay, Wisconsin. But go ahead, I'm sorry. Zeke, that was really fast. Thank you.
The two things that jump out to me there that I would consider is that it's harder to take information and cleanliness for granted in a small company. And that's, sometimes you're going to find small companies that have world-class controllers and they're all dialed on their information and it's going to be spoon-fed to you in a perfect way. But what I would say is, when be really crystal at like the 5 to 10 things that you need to be comfortable and don't concede on those. Even if it's a little painstaking and you're getting into raw information, don't let those 5 to 10 things go, which means you have to have your 5 to 10 things ahead of time. Ryan. If Ryan tells me I got
Ryan Schreiber right says you've been ghosting him all of 2021. Someone tell John to text me back, and then a crying cat good. Face.
I thought he was going to tell me that
to me. I have an appointment with him next week, so I'm waiting for my text from him.
I love me my Ryan.
So I think being like, just drill down and really focus your process on the things that are most important would be number one. And then number two, the network is a little different. You can't just stay in the regular flow with bankers and lawyers that are transacting on deals that Bill looks at. You need to work your region. You need to go find, like here in Phoenix, there's IBG, Fox, and Finn. They're a small investment banker, small regional bank that advises on anything from $1 million in revenue to $20 million in revenue. That's the sweet spot. That's the network you need to develop. Those would be the two things I'd consider for small M&A versus larger size M&A.
Yeah, I mean, just adding maybe a comment to John, you know, part of the problem with acquisitions is it really starts off kind of as a zero sum game anyways, right? You know, the buyer is trying to get a great deal and the seller is trying to get the most money that they can from the transaction. And, you know, you got to move past that as quickly as you can, you know, to get the holy grail, as John calls it, where you know, you get one and one equals three, and you really get to that level of synergy that you're trying to, you know, build with an acquisition. But it starts off with everybody's holding their cards close to the vest and, you know, really coming forth with all of the truth. And, you know, you got to build trust and build rapport and move past that quickly to be able to make sure that you can get that value.
I saw a question from Andrew Teal. We all know I love Andrew Teal. He still won't come on the show and do a session with me called What's the Deal with Andrew Teal. How do you define large, medium, and small? Oh man, Zeke, you're on fire today. Assets in the realm of trucking, or basically it's always defined by revenue? It's a good question.
Bill, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I tend to look at acquisitions maybe a little bit differently, and not only what you're buying, but the potential, right? So you may qualify an opportunity and say X number of assets makes that a small deal or, you know, mid-sized deal, or look at the revenue. But I tend to look at that as the potential through the acquisition, right? What are you really going to get as a result of that acquisition? You know, it's easy to look at that TFI deal and say, yeah, that was a big deal. It costs a lot of money and they're picking up assets. But if that, you know, had zero potential for TFI and, you know, was losing money, everybody would look at that deal completely differently. They'd say, what in the heck? Why would they do this? Why would they spend that money? So, I'm thinking of it also from, you know, when we talked about this, you know, John, you know, is kind of taking the position of I'm the potential buyer and here's what's a good deal and what's a bad deal, and what's in between. And I'm sort of the thinking of how do I integrate that and how do I make that become part of my network? And so I'm always thinking in those terms.
The other question that popped up, which is one that I, and for those of you just joining us, we are talking about whether you can grow organically. Can you also grow through mergers and acquisitions? And then we're going to talk about who's the right type of target soon as well for a merger or as an acquisition. But I have another question from Matt Fink, who says, no names necessary. Would love to hear an example of a giant flop. Me too. I love talking about successes and flops and the reason why it was such a big miss, and perhaps an example of one that was masterfully done. And Mad Hatter, I see you. I see you. That's all I have to say about Mad Hatter, but go ahead. I'll let John or Bill, whoever wants to talk about that. And you can say company A or company B. Like you said, you don't have to do.
Most of these examples, I'm going to try to give public ones, because if you want to go and look into more detail, there's tons of information in the SEC filings and in the press releases around them. So that might be fun to do it. But I look at, I'll say ones that were maybe more masterfully done first. Mm-hmm. And what XPO did with Conway, I think is a great deal. And it falls into the category of more transformational for them. So higher risk, higher reward, right? They didn't have an LTL component. When they added that, they had a clear view of what their brokerage and what their 3PL operations could do within that LTL environment. And then they moved to execution mode. And to Bill's point, they could have paid 20 or 30% more and the deal still would have been a home run. So I agree. I think plenty of deals die because of price. but deals aren't made or lost afterwards because of the price you paid. And I think that's one that was done masterfully.
Right.
The other one I'll give is a little nuanced, and this is the guys in Texas at Daseke probably over the last few years have been on like the flop or bad train, and it tells you that time can change things, that, you know, over the last 7 months and with infrastructure spending coming back and further integration of their portfolio companies, that stock has grown 500% in the last 8 months. So just because something's a flop doesn't mean it can't be worked on and brought back. So those are two that I think of that you could maybe dig into in the public realm and learn a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at a whole bunch of examples, even outside of transportation and logistics, to find the flops, because, you know, the pressure is there on public companies to grow. And so they're constantly, you know, acquisitive and they're looking for opportunities. You know, a couple that come to mind for me, like we'll talk more about culture and how that's important. You know, an obvious cultural clash was probably the Daimler-Chrysler deal, right? So, you don't have to spend a whole lot of time examining, you know, why that failed. But, you know, at the heart of it was a cultural challenge and a problem. And then, you know, sometimes good deals fall apart because of timing. Right. You know, Sears and Kmart's a great example. Two, you know, longstanding great brands, you know, great store networks, you know, a loyal customer base. But, you know, that that principally failed because that merger was taking place right as e-commerce was taking off. They didn't really have the ability to transform their business fast enough into an e-commerce model. Because they were still relying on in-store sales, and that created, you know, the downfall of two great American brands. And that was just timing. Not that it was necessarily a bad idea. It certainly was a great idea.
I love those examples. Man, you guys, like, you knew that question was coming. let's take another step toward, if you've identified that as a leader, you want to acquire a company. How do we value companies? I saw Amanda told me that someone shot a question to me, Fred. And he said, you know, which is a good question. He said, are light asset companies more attractive than heavy asset companies? I see this question a lot. We're like, oh, because I have a final mile customer base, and I have the box trucks, and warehousing, is it more attractive? And it's like, I think people are trying to understand how to value a company and whether it fits with you. And oh, by the way, we are going to get into a conversation at some point about what the fuck are light assets companies. Fred, put in the comments, what is light asset company? Because I know a lot of you brokers like to say, we are light assets. And I'm like, where the fuck's your assets? Your chairs? Your desks? You ain't got no assets. You only have to have trucks to be an asset. So you're talking like box trucks versus OTR trucks. Like what are we talking about, Fred? Put some more comments in here or send them to Amanda Miller. But John or Bill, do you guys have any at least direction for us when we come to valuing a company and making it and deciding whether we want to try? Oh, Andrew Teal's on fire today. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, I can take that one. For me, guys, I think The key thing to keep in mind is what you're going to do with the company. So I'll try to answer both those. On the asset light versus heavy asset, depending on what your conviction and core competencies are, you're going to be able to do a hell of a lot more with one of the companies. So if you can use it to, you know, exponentially increase sales and improve your profit margins, go with the asset heavy company. If that's what you can do on the asset light side, and they've got a killer sales team, a great culture, they've only penetrated a portion of the US and you think they can move past that, that's awesome. And that will also direct how you value the company. So a key to how you value is being able to look at the historical performance of the business, but over the next 3 to 4 years, what you really believe is going to happen. And then you can build a return profile and test it against what your parameters are. I think one of the things of taking a step back and looking at your whole system, you look at your areas that you need to grow or areas that you need to improve profits. And when an opportunity is presented that does that and fits within your strategy, you'll be prepared to do the analysis and look and say, hey, this gets us where we want to be on truckload, or this gets us where we want to be on light asset, or whatever Matt called it.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring up at least that people keep in mind, because I get this question a lot. If you're a broker and you're light asset or you have zero assets and you're thinking about buying a company with assets, here's one thing that people miss all the time, including the people who step into the trucking industry and they're like, I'm going to start a trucking company. I have this cash because, you know, whatever I did, buy some trucks. There is such a big difference between running a brokerage and running a trucking company. A lot of people know this. Yeah, yada, yada, yeah, Cassandra. But you still, y'all go out and buy this trucking company and it's an utter fail because you need trucking people when you buy the trucking company. And you got to understand them. And it's hard to merge those two types of companies together when logistics only knows logistics and trucking only knows trucking. It's one of the hardest things to do in our industry. So just think about that, you got y'all, before you start thinking, I'm going to go out and buy this trucking company or this mode that I've never engaged in before.
That's right. Yeah. The risks go up exponentially when suddenly you're stepping into a space that you have no experience in. Doesn't mean it can't work.
Right.
It means, to your point, you got to bring in the right people to help you. You can't assume, hey, because I know how to run a fleet, that I suddenly know how to work as a broker or vice versa. And a lot of deals fail just simply for that reason. Don't have experience in that space. Mm-hmm. And egos get in the way, and suddenly, you know, the buyer thinks they're smarter than the seller or smarter than everyone else in the industry. I'm suddenly the only one who's figured this whole thing out. And then suddenly they're not listening. They're just not listening to the people around them that are telling them, you know, this is a disaster, and they just keep going down the path that they originally set for themselves.
And then you have a company who's trying to, the company that acquired the company with a different mode, trying to squish them into your current company. And they're like, we don't fit. We don't fit.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so common. Oh my God. But it happens all the time. Oh, sorry. Keep going, you guys. We have a lot of questions rolling in. Maybe I should.
By the way, before I take my drink of my perfectly non-alcoholic beer, because I'm going to a meeting right after this and everybody will accuse me of drinking. This is non-alcoholic ginger beer.
It is, Bill. It's only noon for him, you guys. And he told me he was going to drink non-alcoholic beer. And I was like, why? It'll make your meeting so much better if you just drink the beer. come on now. Okay, so Amanda says, okay, wait. There was a question from Ron. Zeke, it was all the way up and it was about UPS buying Coyote. And I thought it was a good one, but Amanda's got to step away for a second. So there's something like she has a job. Oh, man. What was it? It was like, what's UPS going to do with Coyote now that UPS doesn't have assets? Oh, there it is. Dang, Zeke, you're so good. Ron Kane says, an over the beer conversation, but curious as to opinions. What does UPS do with Coyote now that they sold their fleet? Is it now a distraction or another opportunity to sell an asset? Ooh. Anybody have any opinions, or you want to pass?
I don't have any strong opinions on it. I think that the UPS CEO statement on focusing on the core does make you wonder if it were something that, you know, they would evaluate additional pruning. But I think regardless, having the ability to be tied into the market will continue to be a strategic advantage of UPS's. But the way that they report and the way that information is out, you really can't tell whether or not that is a successful marriage or not. Bill would have a better guess than me on how that integration may be going.
Yeah, I'd say the same thing. Like, it's hard to speculate what they're going to do. I mean, I think a lot of people were probably caught off guard at them selling UPS Freight. I don't think that was something that was publicly speculated a lot about. And when it came out, everybody was like, So, you know, I think if they were going to make a decision like that with Coyote, it'd be the same thing. I mean, it's not going to be something they're going to run around talking about publicly.
Interesting.
Yeah, you know, it is kind of funny though, when not funny, but I guess it does point to, you know, this whole issue of understanding, you know, the value of the acquisition. So when, you know, when they originally went out and bought Overnight, you know, they were building out, you know, this network that, you know, they could address customers' needs across all modes, right? They could, you know, they can handle parcel, they can handle, handle truckload, they can handle global freight forwarding. And now when, what's driving them along with other integrators and other large global 3PLs to say, we're going back to our core. But I mean, what is that?
What
pressure point that forces someone to say, this is not working for me? And then you start to tear that apart, which is interesting. You know, I worked at FedEx for,
oh my God, Bill, it's kind of like when the girlfriend tells you it's not you, it's me. I need to go back to who I am.
That hurts. I've heard that
before. We all have. It's like, oh man.
Yeah. I mean, having worked at FedEx, it was interesting, you know, I worked there for 15 years on the international freight forwarding side. And, you know, obviously one of our strongest competitors was UPS. And that bundle that they offered was really powerful. The fact that you could, you know, take your consolidated spend as a shipper with UPS and combine your freight forwarding and combine your LTL and combine your parcel to improve your earned discount, that was really effective for a lot of shippers and made it difficult to compete in some cases. And now they're removing that option for the bundle. Mm-hmm. So what happened for those shippers who said, you know, I really, you know, this is not a knock against UPS Freight, but, you know, that may have been a driving factor for why they chose to use them versus some other competitor in the LTL space.
Ron's mirroring something that I've said, which is, isn't back to our core really mean we fucked up and we need to start over? I'm like, yeah, this is why I love Ron. If I could get him on every show, I would, because that's the way I read it too. And I think that, you know, I know that Schneider went through this a little bit with Watkins Shepherd too. I think that they did the, I don't know if they've actually said that, but the, we need to get back to our core. And that, you know, when you try to get into the final mile space and you're a full truckload company, I'm sure that there's some complications there as well. So we have 15 minutes left. Here's what I want to talk about. Two things. First, John, for those out there who own a trucking company or brokerage, and they actually want to be acquired and they want to be seen as a valuable option, what's your advice to them from a high level perspective? Obviously, they have to hire you for real shit, but to tell, like, hey, what do I need to start doing?
You cut out, but Cassandra, I think that the question's a good one, which is, if you're planning your roadmap for what you want to do with your business, and this is part of the reason that you know, Shannon and I left Knight Swift Transportation, was we see that there is a ton of continued fragmentation in both truckload and in brokerage. And the time's right, right? You see entrants like Amazon coming in and doing things that are highly, bully's not the right word, but they're obviously very big. So when they move, they don't move slowly, right? You got a ship moving through a swimming pool.
Yep.
When they decide to push into things. So whether they're hitting containers or whether they're doing brokerage, they're coming through. So there's a ton of disruption. You've got autonomous that could take 4 or 40 years to roll out. But if I'm a little guy, I kind of think, hey, the next 5 years probably isn't a bad time to get my shit in order, plan for the next generation. So that'd be where I would start. Is one of the things that I hit earlier about the difference between small M&A and big M&A is you can't assume that the information is well organized, that it's methodical. So is to reach out to an advisor. So we're with FE Advisory Group here in Phoenix. Find one in your area or call us and have a conversation around what to start setting up. Because there is, you know, there's a lot of deals that I've seen that either for price, and that's usually the fact that price is disconnected from reality, or a surprise in diligence where someone wasn't well organized,
yep,
or they weren't up front with a problem. So getting that advice early on how to package your information, get some feedback on, hey, how does this story look? Where am I weak? Where am I strong? Can allow you like some time. It can allow you 6 months, and it can allow you a year to start getting your information in order, so you will be positioned really well when you do decide to go to market. Because it hits you right on top of your day job. It is unbelievably time consuming, and the time is nothing compared to the mental kind of commitment that you make as an owner when you're thinking about selling your baby. So I would say getting things organized and reaching out to an advisor early would be the two things that I would consider.
Yeah, adding to John's comment about, I mean, this goes back to when you asked the question about what makes a small, a mid-size, and a large acquisition. You know, a lot of that just simply has to do with the complexity of the integration, right? Not the size of the deal itself. Some deals can be quite small in terms of revenue or, you know, price, acquisition price, but fail just because they are really complicated. And, you know, either you've underestimated that complexity, or you really didn't understand the business model, and, you know, those potential problem areas or gaps weren't identified early on in the process. And so you didn't have the right steps in place to, you know, kind of implement the needed change in the integration. Or a big deal, you know, so let's say you're on similar systems that are kind of an easy lift from a, you know, IT perspective, as well as maybe, you know, strong cultural fit and similar management approach and style become a lot faster. So, yeah, I mean, John, I think you did a really good job of, you know, elaborating on this, you know, consideration of you really need to start with considering your alternatives to that acquisition, too. Like, if it's your only way and you haven't looked at any other options, you're going to set yourself down that path and continue down that path, whether it's right or not. And, you know, that sets up problems for you later.
Yeah. Well, it looks like we lost Cassandra, Bill. I had two notes that you'd mentioned to us before that I'll ask in more speed round. So yeah. You looked at a lot of deals, as have I. So if you were to highlight your biggest turn on or turn off, right, for a deal, what would be your biggest thing that gets you most excited about a deal when you see one?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's transparency, right? Like, you know, when you get an initial introduction into a company and you see that they're using a lot of puffery and they're sort of building up their network to be more than it really is, and you already know that it's untrue, you're like, wait a minute, come on. You know, I've been in the business long enough. I know that's not how the company operates. That's an immediate turnoff and sets the stage for distrust for me right away. You know, one of the things that, you know, if it's a turn on is someone just being honest about where, you know, the warts do lie, right? You know, they're willing to tell you that not everything's perfect, and here's where we have problems. And maybe that, you know, could be from a systems perspective or a people perspective or just the business. If you can get to those conversations early, then I get excited about the deal, because then I feel like, you know, I'm not going to suddenly uncover something either post integration or just, you know, at the 11th hour that I go, oh shit, like, this is, you know, why didn't you tell me this in the first place? Like, why are we even doing this deal?
Yeah, I would say for me, my turn off falls directly in line with yours. And I think part of the problem, though, Bill, and I want to hear what your percentage is I would say a solid 50% of the deals that I look at have some level of either hockey stick, puffery, or they're overplaying the additional growth areas, right? All of a sudden, when someone goes to sell their company, they have an unbelievably active M&A process, right? Correct. We've got 20 deals in the pipeline. We got them coming out, and we can buy them at half the typical multiple. You're like, well, how many have you closed in the last 2 years? Well, none yet, but there's a lot that are percolating right now. This just happens to be the perfect time. So I agree. My turn off would be just a disconnect from reality and openness. And I think one of the things when we look at working with sellers at FV Advisory, it would be just be upfront, be honest, know who you are. And yes, you want to make your strengths as pronounced as possible, but don't go grab three new things that you thought about one time or you talked about at last year's annual session and grab it and say, that sounds really good. Because you will learn, you'll lose the audience really quick. For me, the biggest turn on would be a strong management team. And I think it goes hand in hand. You've got a management team that understands how their business functions, where its strengths are, who carries what water, what the past has held and what the future holds, it's honestly really, really enticing.
Yeah, I mean, to add to that too, John, the thing, here's another thing that is kind of easy to pick up on too, is when a company strips down the company and throws a bunch of new leadership into the company, you know, to prop it up for a sale. You want to, it's not only having strong management and leadership in the company, it's having experienced leadership and management. So, you know, those leaders need to have been in place for some time and not just there to make the company look more attractive, right? They need to understand the business. They need to be connected with the people that they're leading and supposed to be supporting have to believe in them. They're not just, they can't be just placeholders and people that have been thrown into a role. And you can see it too, when it's so easy to look at a company and see when they've stripped out cost to, you know, to pump up their EBITDA, to, you know, hopefully pump up their multiple in the deal. I mean, you can chase that down pretty quickly. And when you see that, that's, you know, that's not attractive as an acquisition for most potential buyers.
Agreed.
So thank you for being patient. I think that Matt Hatter, which I don't know this person's name, I'll find out, jinxed me, and my internet just froze completely on him. But while I was resetting my computer, I was listening to you guys, amazing conversation. I think that, we have 7 minutes left. One thing we haven't talked about yet is, where is the growth in the industry? What is the difference between chasing a trend and then finding true opportunity in the industry, if that makes sense? Like, honestly, I hear this drives me up the wall, and I talked about this a little bit at Lean Solutions Group's mastermind event in Vegas. We had like a private event, and I talked about the difference between, like, they get FOMO with certain companies and technology. And I'll ask them, they'll be like, oh, I really want to be an investor. I want to buy this company. It's amazing. And I'll ask them, have you seen the technology? How much do you know about the company? And they're like, well, we haven't seen the technology yet, but we hear they have a great interface. They have a great app and that everybody loves working, blah, blah, blah. So if you could dive into a little bit about, hey, if you are just looking to invest or you're looking to be part of where the growth is in the industry, where is that growth?
Yeah, from my perspective, so you know, I just kind of the place where that happens a lot, and I hear this a lot, especially on the international forwarding side, has been, you know, the digital freight marketplaces and the digital freight forwarders. You know, everybody seems, I mean, they get a lot of press and they, you know, mm-hmm. really good job and, you know, stating that, you know, we're all antiquated and nobody has invested, made the necessary investments in systems and, you know, don't provide the levels of intelligence that they can. And, yeah, I look at that as like, hey, there's room for all of us. I mean, the mm-hmm. markets are massive. And it's more about knowing your customer and playing to your strengths versus just trying to chase the, you know, what's hot and what suddenly, you know, is attractive from, you know, an acquisition perspective or a valuation perspective. I mean, you got to just, you know, I mean, you really have to be careful to not get caught up in that. We've seen lots of people make those kinds of mistakes. Having said that, you know, like I do believe, you know, some of the competitors that are in this digital, the digital freight space, if you want to call it that, you know, have challenged all of us to get a lot better with our intelligence. And that's fine. You know, you make the investments to improve your own technology, make the investments to become more efficient, make the investments to, you know, help your employees and help your customers. But we don't all have to be, you know, Uber or Convoy or Flexport. You know, there's room for us all. And the market's just massive.
It is massive. And there are a lot of people who are investing a ton of money and growing their company that don't have the flashy marketing going on. They're just plugging along and doing the thing and they have great tech.
Right.
John, did you have anything to tag on to that, this topic? If not, yeah. There's another question that popped up.
Yeah, I would just quickly say that ultimately we are in a mature industry. That yes, tech is finding new ways to do that. We don't operate on stone tablets, as people would like you to believe.
They do. They think we're all fucking dumb, and they're like,
yeah,
oh,
just cave. We're just cavemen and cave women. But there's certainly a role for that, and it's a mm-hmm. huge addressable market that is amazingly fragmented. And when I think about growth verticals within that, certainly developing your technology to play in that game and try to figure out how to take advantage is one thing. The other would just be to evaluate tucking in and purchasing companies that are in the sector. There's still an unbelievable amount of tens of thousands of brokers and trucking companies.
Yeah. So much. Robert says, have either of you made a bad deal and immediately knew it was a dud?
I'll take that one.
The years you have in this industry, you've got to have some good ones for us.
Yeah. So one I wasn't involved with, and one I was. I was 4 months in at the private equity firm, and what funny enough, they were both alternative energy fuel deals, low dollars in the scheme of things, but had a better process. And what I would tell you is, when you don't know crap about that type of technology, make sure you're going deep on bringing experts in and looking at it. Have them mm-hmm. oversee the process, sit with it for 24 hours, examine the inputs, examine the outputs, find an expert. So whether it's M&A, you're doing that. Certainly if within a particular thing, you're not an expert, pay the money and get someone. It wasn't big dollars, but the technology was, it was just bad and it didn't work. You lose your money when you do.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Yeah. You know, one thing, because of time, that we didn't talk about, maybe I'll just speak just real quickly is, you know, when you're the, company that's being acquired and the approach that you should take is really important. You know, a lot of times, you know, an acquisition is made, you start to bring together the management teams and employees that are part of the company that have been acquired, hold on for dear life to whatever it is about the company that they, you know, used to work for, and, you know, point to a million reasons why the deal is going to fail and why these ideas are ridiculous that the leadership team is coming forward with. And sometimes they are. I mean, they are stupid ideas, like it happens. But, you know, you have to be really careful about that, because the acquiring company wants to know what areas need to be fixed and where things can be improved. But frankly, they don't want to hear they're wrong. And
right.
I mean, that is, even if they are wrong, and even if you're smarter than they are, you have to be open and willing to have conversations and not just sort of shoot the deal down, because their employees are like fall into probably three camps. There's one camp where they love it. They're super excited. We should have done this a long time ago. I'm all on board. I want to be a part of this. Mm-hmm. Then the wait and see people who are like, meh, you know, this shit happens all the time.
Yeah. And hope I don't get fired.
Right. I'm not going to get involved, and I'm not going to stick my neck out. I'm not going to do anything like that. And then you have the naysayers who are over here pointing their fingers at everything. They're like, this is
exactly who they are.
Dumbass idea. Why are we doing this? I've been doing this for 30 years and I'm not going to change. And this is stupid. And all of that. And again, some of that stuff could be really stupid. But, you know, my recommendation, you know, would be, so when I first got in the business in 1992, I worked for a small customs broker and freight forwarder here in Seattle. They were bought, you know, 6 months later by a larger forwarder. And then that company was eventually bought by FedEx. So I went through it on, you know, sort of multiple sides, and then I've been on the acquiring and integration side. And just over and over and over, I'd listen to people around me like,
same pattern.
Man, like, why? Like, it's not helpful. It just is not helpful. I mean, you know, you don't want to be like a yes man and say everything's a great idea and this is beautiful and oh yeah, I love you. You're amazing and suck up to all your new bosses. That's not helpful either. I mean, people see through that. But you know, my recommendation is get involved. Don't wait. Don't wait for someone to come along and ask you your opinion and, you know, ask you to join a team or whatever, a cross-functional team, or, you know, collaborate. But, you know, get involved. Say, I want to be a part of making this a success, and find a way to help instead of being a burden to the success, because you won't be there if you do. You just won't. It's
so true. I've been through it so many times, and I'm always, I've been through a couple times with we acquired the other company. And I quickly identify the people you just categorized.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so easy to identify them. And I'm like, oh boy. And I'm always looking for the one who's positive and wants to be part of the movement and is okay with it. And those people tend to get so much opportunity because they have a better attitude about everything. But sometimes it is sad to see your company is about to get change. Everything's changing. And it's scary. I get that too.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a way to hold on to the legacy of a company and, you know, preserve and protect and sort of, you know, create that, hey, we wouldn't even be here in the first place if this company had not been a great company. It's everything they did that allowed us to get to this place. So you don't want to just scrap throw that out the window. You can do both. I mean, there's plenty of examples of that. You know, and I it's important to me, having lived that a couple of times. Like, I don't want to throw that away, but I, like 10 years later, after that little customs broker and freight forwarder that was acquired, you know, there were still people who would go run around and say, oh, you're from that company or you're from that company. And, you know, point to that as our legacy. So,
yep, for sure.
So you both hit on, and I know we got to wrap up here in a minute, Cassandra, but you both hit on the people that are there that are being acquired. You know, being part of the Knight Swift merger, one thing I think the team did really well, and Bill, I can tell by your demeanor, what you've talked about on transparency and trust that, that this would be what you do. But people, when you go in, right, and you're acquiring someone, are going to, by nature, think through things, one, very personally, right, for themselves, and two, they're going to draw the worst possible fear. Like, that's going to already be in their head. And where I do see people miss is that if you're the acquirer and you're buying a company, could be cheap or could be to make big changes, is you're not just upfront that there are going to be changes and just yeah. own it. Because mm-hmm. people's minds are already racing. Mm-hmm. They're just running. And it's literally like the worst possible scenario. They're going to fire us all. This is going to happen. If you don't just go in and let them know, yes, there will be changes. We're looking in these areas. It doesn't let anyone just exhale this sigh of some relief, right? It's not perfect and you're not in there handing out lollipops, but you just let everyone know, yes, we are evaluating these few things. It goes a long way. So,
yeah.
That's great advice.
I mean, I say this all the time. Have the tough conversations. Have them. You know, trust that people are mature enough and can understand the implications of, you know, some of those decisions. Don't avoid them. I mean, because then, like you say, you know, when you don't have that conversation, somebody is always cooking up a worst case scenario behind the scenes. And it's not just in their head. They're having that conversation with everybody around them. And there's a huge vacuum going on that gets filled with something, which is normally doom in the end of the world. Instead of reality. So have those conversations. Trust people. So people can handle them. And when they're, you know, struggling, it's okay to accept that. Like, you know, accept that people are, you know, afraid or uncomfortable or uneasy.
I feel like that was a really good point to end on. And it was so funny because often toward the end of the podcast, when everybody starts warming up, is when the best points actually come out. And I always tell people, keep watching, because at the end usually is where all the really golden nuggets come in. Thank you to Swan Leap for sponsoring this. The link is in my comments for 6 months free of Swan Leap's TMS. And also the link for my website. My new website where you can watch, you can sign up for the newsletter, you can check things out, see what things look like, the new branding. Thank you to Lean Marketing for that website. Reach out to Lean Marketing if you guys are interested in having new graphics and new websites just like I have. John, Bill, I can't thank you enough. You guys were amazing guests, and I love it because we got to nerd out big time on this episode. So I hope you guys come back. You know what we should do is next time there's like a big merger or a big acquisition, we come in and we can have like a, let's do a little video of like, what do the experts think about this? Is it going to be a flip or a flop? Like something like that we should do.
Monday morning quarterbacking.
Oh, yes. This is my favorite.
Easy to sit on.
So I'll let Zeke end the broadcast and you guys can stay on if you want and talk to me afterward. But thank you everybody at Metropolis and have a great weekend.